This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you, Sabrina, for the news. My name is Rich Bradbury. This, of course, is Enterprise BizBytes. I'm joined in the studio by
Frida Liu
and Christine Wong.
We, as usual, will be with you all the way through until 1 o'clock this afternoon. If you want to get in touch with our show, get us on WhatsApp 018-789-8899 or on Twitter at BFM Radio. Do you both have a good weekend?
Very.
Yes.
Yeah, very chill.
Very
nice.
Chill. Very chill.
Caught up on my Netflix.
Caught up on your Netflix, yes.
I watched Extreme in concert.
Oh, nice. How was that?
It was really good. Of course, we were all waiting for that one song. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they had other hits and all that. But Nuno Bettencourt, he's a brilliant guitarist.
Just a brilliant guitarist,
of
is it?
Of course.
Oh, yes. She's got a wink and a smile there.
Hashtag marry me, please.
So speaking about Netflix, we're going to be starting off very shortly with a Netflix story about how Netflix and Facebook are helping to reduce youth crime in New South Wales. We'll then move on to a story about Airbnb, helping to sign up to donate emergency housing before a disaster. Frida's got Here's How Your Brain Can Be Less Racist. Mm. Interesting topic.
Yeah.
And then Google's new disappearing email option. That's all coming up very shortly. Let's kick off then with the Netflix story. So youth crime in New South Wales has declined significantly in the last two decades, in part due to young people spending more time at home on the internet and less time hanging out on the street, according to new research from the Australian National University. The research looked at New South Wales police data of crime rates for people aged 10 to 21 who were born in 1984 compared to those born in 1994. So the results showed that by the age of 21, the proportion of the population that had come into contact with the criminal justice system had halved, with particularly significant decreases in vehicle theft, down 59%, property theft, down 59%, and drink driving, down 49%. So lead researcher and criminologist Dr. Jason Payne, what a great name for a criminologist, of the Research School of Social Sciences, said there's little doubt that the decline was in part due to the changing habits of young people. And here's a quote. Young people are spending less time in unsupervised environments where opportunistic offending may be more attractive, like hanging out on the streets. An increased use of home entertainment and social media is also reducing opportunities for traditional forms of crime. However, Dr. Payne then warned, while more time in a digital environment may help reduce traditional crime, it may also open the door to newer forms of criminal activity.
Like Narcos, watching Narcos.
Like watching Narcos, yeah.
And Breaking
so
Bad.
Those native to social media may explore antisocial and criminal behaviours online, which at present attract far less scrutiny from parents and authorities. Further analysis of the data found the biggest decrease was seen amongst those who would normally only have one interaction with the police, whilst there was less significant reductions in chronic repeat offenders. The data shows a large reduction in the number of young people committing crime for the first time, although there remains a hardcore of prolific offenders. For both the 1984 and 1994 cohorts, 19 was the peak age for young offending. The researchers also found increasing security of personal and public property was like another reason for the reduced youth crime rates. So other statistics, violent offending saw a decline of 32%, property offending saw a decline of 56%, drug offending saw a decline of 22%, the smallest of the online of the offense specific declines. So the amount of time we've spent here, bashing social media and people spending time online, the statistics have proven, well, logically, that staying at home means you get involved in less crime.
Mm. Well, point being, you know, the things that we've talked about where we have criticized social media, I think those points definitely still stand because that's a whole other set of problems. But also, duh. Because with the advent of, you know, all these digital distractions, there's not a lot of reasons to leave the house anymore. I mean, back in the day, when I was younger, you know, you would hang out with your friends occasionally, but the most time that you spent talking to your friends was on MSN Messenger.
Right.
So you didn't really have an opportunity to make mischief because you were just nudging each other on MSN Messenger all the time.
Right.
That was about as much as we needed to get the catharsis out of our system.
Next week's story, obesity increases.
Obesity increases, yes. Diabetes is up tenfold and one thing or another.
Yeah.
But you're right. I mean, when I was a kid, there was definitely an awful lot of hanging out at the shops and one thing or another. And there was always kids, you know, wanting to cause trouble because they had nothing to do.
Yeah.
You know, and you try to talk to these folks. Yeah, let's go and read a book. And they don't want to do that. Of course they don't want to do that. I mean, but I don't know. I mean, it's nice to see that in New South Wales. It would be nice to see what kind of figures there are reflected in different countries where there's less internet penetration and stuff like that.
I would also be interested in seeing exactly what these kids are doing. These kids, as if I'm not one of them. I'd be interested in seeing what kind of media these people are consuming as well. Whether it might be media that is maybe more violent, and then they're kind of emotionally, having that sort of catharsis, and that's why they don't feel inclined to go out and actually, make trouble.
Yeah.
It would be interesting to see exactly what kind of things they're consuming. Because, for example, people who play like Grand Theft Auto and stuff like that, they can kind of get all of the destructive fantasies in the game. Mm. They don't have to do that in real life anymore. So it would be interesting to see that.
All right. Let us know what you think, folks. 018-789-8899. More fun to spend time at home? Less chance of getting into crime? Let us know. Okay, move on to story number two, Chris. Airbnb, what's this about the donating emergency housing?
Okay, so what is specifically the focus of the headline is that Airbnb will let hosts sign up to donate emergency housing before a disaster. Let's be clear that Airbnb last year unveiled a program called Open Homes, and it's already designed to allow Airbnb hosts to provide emergency housing, but only after a disaster has already happened. So within the Open Homes program, homeowners can allow refugees or evacuees to find housing on a short notice for free. But what they're doing now is that Airbnb is now expanding the Open Homes program with a pilot project that will allow hosts to list their properties ahead of a disaster. So instead of just, a disaster happens and then suddenly you can just turn on the Airbnb app and wait for people to tell you that they're ready, you can sign up to like a pre-approved list of people.
Okay. Yeah.
So that when a disaster does strike, those in need don't necessarily have to wait for said hosts to come forward in the aftermath. What the program will also do as well is that it matches up users willing to donate space with people who are called emergency managers, who then connect people who need housing with available space. The program will also come with some in-person preparedness training and recruitment events for hosts. So if you want to put your home on Airbnb for this purpose, they will actually give you some training on how to deal with an emergency situation as well. And they're also going to release a new marketing campaign and new protocols for communicating with local emergency management to match up available space with those who need it. Since the program has launched in 2017, its collective community has actually donated 17,000 nights for those in need already.
Do we know which cities this is mainly based around?
So, as with most things that we talk about on BizBytes, this is starting in America. It's specifically launching first with the city of San Jose?
Yeah.
In California. And then after that, it will expand to other cities, I'm assuming within America and then hopefully worldwide.
I know Hawaii needs it now.
For sure it does, yeah. Great idea, though.
Huh? Right? I mean, this is a great, which is a great CSR idea thing around what their business is all about, right? Mm. And that's a great extension. And, 17,000 nights.
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
Okay, let's take a short break. We've got some music coming up from Prince. It is Dreamer. When we get back, our story about here's how your brain can learn to be less racist. Don't forget, we do have the WhatsApp line open, 018-789-8899. Started off with a story about how Netflix and Facebook have helped reduce youth crime. Are you seeing any benefits from this here in Malaysia? Do we see that? Kids spending more time at home on their social media? Or are they still going out and wrecking things? Let us know, 018-789-8899.
Bodacious, fabulous minds. BFM 89.9, the business station.
Welcome back to Enterprise Biz Bytes. My name is Rich Bradbury. As usual, I'm joined in the studio by
Frida Liu
and Christine Wong.
We started off the show today with a story about how Netflix and Facebook are helping to reduce youth crime. Basically, people staying at home equals less crime. It seems like a bit of a non-brainer, really, but some of the results are down quite significantly. We have some crime rates down by 39% in places. Violent crime was down 37%, I believe. But let's move on to our next story. It's a story that Frida has about here's how your brain can learn to be less racist. This is really interesting.
Very, very interesting topic. So, this is a study that came out in 68, and of course, there's a follow up to it. So, in 1968, the Polish American psychologist Robert Zajonc, I'm going to say his name once. So, he conducted a study at the University of Michigan. He recruited students and told them they'd be participating in a language learning experiment, but this was just a cover for his true intentions. Instead, he began by showing them fake Chinese characters that he claimed signified various adjectives, then continued to display each character to subjects over and over at various frequencies, some as many as 25 times, either just once or not at all. Finally, he asked each student volunteer to guess how positive or negative the definition of each adjective was. That is, did it represent a good trait or a bad trait, and how much they liked it. He discovered there was a strong linear relationship between familiarity and not just how positively his subjects interpreted his utterly meaningless characters, but with how much they liked it too. So the more students saw a given character, the more they preferred it. So his research later became the foundation of the well-documented mere exposure effect, whereby the more we're exposed to something, the better we like it, right? So which begs an obvious question, does this apply to people too, right? And it got me thinking, if there's more exposure, help our brains unlearn unconscious biases and assumptions, including racist ones. So fast forward to 2012, right? This is Leslie Zebrowitz and Yi Zhang at Brandeis University. They set out to answer these questions in a study. So their question was simple. What would happen at the cognitive level if they showed people faces of individuals of different ethnicities over and over? And so what they decided to focus, so I'm going to get a bit technical here.
Let's do it.
All right, on the orbitofrontal cortex, which is tied to the reward system of our brains. It drives two different reflexes that helps our brains assess a situation before we take action. Specifically, the orbitofrontal cortex roles tells whether we're better off approaching or avoiding a person, place, or thing. But it's made up of a few component parts. So our mind's so-called approach reflex can be measured by observing activity in the medial orbitofrontal cortex. So when this area of the brain is activated, your motor system eggs you on to engage with someone or something. So as Zhang explained to him, in a gambling setting, if you start to win money, the medial orbitofrontal is where the brain activates the most because it registers positive rewards.
Uh-huh.
Now, the lateral orbitofrontal cortex registers what brain scientists refer to as our avoidance reflex, which cues the bodies to run away to avoid a possible negative outcome. So the stronger the activation, the more pronounced the feeling. So when you start to lose money, she said, the lateral orbitofrontal is a region that activates more because that's when you feel bad about the situation.
So they
wanted to learn whether repeated exposure would either increase approach reflex or decrease avoidance reflex. So as Zhang put it, is it because we start to feel better about this dose stimuli, or is it that we start to feel less bad about them, right? Mm-hmm. So the researchers conducted an MRI study of 16 white men and 16 white women. It always starts with them, don't we? So each participant was exposed to pictures drawn from a collection of black faces, Korean faces, written Chinese characters, real ones, and random shapes. So these pictures were shown different numbers of times to the study participants, with some pictures never shown and others shown many times. So next, the researchers put each participant into the MRI machine, exposed them to 40 images they've never seen before and 20 they had. And the idea was to see how and where the brain would react. So what they found was that the unfamiliar ones images just activated subjects to avoidance reflex. Simply put, people were afraid of the unknown, right? More than just for faces, the same effect occurred when respondents were exposed to unfamiliar shapes and Chinese characters. This makes sense. Humans have evolved to fear the unknown because it signals potential harm.
Right.
However, the study's subjects' avoidance reflex was significantly reduced when they're exposed to the same faces, shapes, and characters they've seen before going into the MRI machine. So he also observed another surprising effect. This is Zhang. Once our participants have been exposed to a prototypical Korean face, she explains, they start to show less adverse reactions to other faces in the same racial category. So the Japanese and the Chinese were then saved. So indeed, familiarity actually helped subjects' brains generalize from particular images they're exposed to, helping reduce race-based biases. So familiarity in this case does not breed contempt.
That's really interesting.
Right? So I think we're more... I'm just thinking of, like, you know, like how in this part of the world, right, we didn't have a lot of Africans coming in. And so what we've seen in TV and everything, and of course, I was just talking in the staircase with you, you know, like, you know, they're usually bigger, they're usually burly, they sound louder, and because we're not so exposed to it, I have my fears as well. And just like over the years, you know, there's more exposure to them, there are more of them coming, so that has reduced as well. And are we avoiding it, or is it a positive? But, you know, that's very interesting, yeah?
This actually reminds me of something that I saw. I think, I forget who covered this exactly, but I think this was on NPR. But this guy, this African-American blues musician called Daryl Davis, actually convinced 200 Ku Klux Klan members to renounce their way of life.
I remember seeing that.
Because he went out of his way to talk to them and familiarize them with himself and to have these conversations, just like not even attacking or trying to actively convert anyone, but just to understand like why they thought the way that they thought. And the more that they talked to him, the more I think they realized like, oh, I don't know why I was so against you in the first place. And it was really incredible. And I think that, you know, that anecdote really supports that scientific evidence right. that, you know, the fact that they were familiar with him made them realize that maybe he wasn't something to be scared of.
Right. So it's also went on to say that we know with increased familiarity, neither change nor increase. Familiarity does not make us like things more. Rather, it makes us fear things less.
Yeah.
So this is one reason why we typically enjoy our own homes, people and objects that that are familiar, we feel safe. We may not particularly like that old chair we inherited from our grandmother. It's not that great to sit in and it clearly needs re-upholstering, but it gives us comfort. Yeah. We have around.
I mean, I'm wondering if there are like outliers to this and other things that no matter, you know, how much you expose yourself to them, that your fear never goes away for certain things. Mm. You know, whether it be creepy crawlies or certain animals or one thing or another. And I'm just curious as to why that is. I mean, if you're exposed to something over and over again, because they talk about exposure therapy quite a lot, right? Why is it that there are some things that no matter how much you are exposed to them?
Like snakes.
It's that fear is still there.
Mm.
That's it.
Okay, so it went on to say that, you know, I guess once we take a first few steps from our biases, our brains know where to go from there. Okay, like this fear of snakes, right? Or my friend has this fear of cats. And so, which is very difficult in Malaysia when you're in a kopitiam to come there. So, but now you're able to sort of like step back. Doesn't mean she likes cats anymore, but okay, you know, calm down. They're not going to bite. You know, so you're able to sort of step away from it once you're aware of it. But I don't think it completely removes the fear unless you go for hypnotherapy and say that something.
Same thing with me as well, where I have this like almost quite debilitating fear of many creepy crawlies, including butterflies, which doesn't make any sense. But over time, like it's taken me literally years to get used to ants and mosquitoes. And I live in a tropical country. So, you know, and that's something where
butterflies,
I don't like them. So what has happened for me is that for crawling insects, I'm kind of okay with them. I don't like them, but I can deal with them because I logic it away by saying that, you know, all they can do is crawl. You know, flying insects, though, I still haven't gotten over because they're unpredictable.
Right.
And they can just fly at you, which is why I don't like butterflies.
My brother's girlfriend has a very similar fear. She has a fear of moths.
Mm.
Of course, you've seen the size of some of the moths that we have here in Malaysia. When she came to visit,
they should turn up.
It turned up. It did. You know, she stepped out of the lift and sure enough, there was one as big as the palm of your hand on the wall. And she just froze. And there's nothing you can do when somebody is like that, you know? It was very strange. I mean, I have my own fears, but to be afraid of something like that, I don't understand why. But that's different people, right?
It's completely irrational, but fact of the matter is the more it takes time for you to just kind of either find yourself a bit more familiar with the concept of them or to try and find some sort of logic where you can at least deal with them without running out of the room immediately.
Okay, we have to take a short break. Let's have some music. We'll have the Rolling Stones with Beast of Burden. We'll also have Guana Bats with See Through. We've got a quick message though. Let's go to that first, Christine.
Yeah, so this is from Twitter. Hello, from @B_Rays, who just says, spending more time with social media seems more dark than the traditional crime that's been spoken about. It is a different kind of headache. It's an addiction that is hard to control rather than just saying no to going out.
I agree. Okay, let's take that break. Rolling Stones coming up. Beast of Burden here on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Because feelings matter. BFM 89.9.
Welcome back to Enterprise BizBytes. Final story of the day before we give you some events that you might want to check out later on in the week. It's about Google's new disappearing email option and how they've said it won't be a liability for companies, insisting it isn't the Snapchat of email. Some people tend to disagree, though. Chris?
Yes. So in April, Google announced that Gmail would be getting a whole slew of new features. If you use Gmail frequently, you may have already seen the new Gmail layout as well. And one of those features is one that sounds a lot like Snapchat. So what it is that it's called the confidential mode. And it lets users set an expiration date on outgoing emails so that the content of the email eventually disappears. Now, Microsoft Outlook, Exchange, and some other third-party extensions already offer a similar feature, but Gmail's version is more widely accessible and easier to use as well. It's already rolled out to personal account holders, and later this summer, it'll be available to business accounts as well. However, of course, just last year, Uber was forced to admit that it had relied on one of these extensions called Wicker to communicate internally during the period of time that Google alleged the ride-sharing company was stealing technology from its self-driving car division. And the messages were never retrieved, and the case ultimately ended in a settlement, which was seen as a win for Uber. So because now Google has released this confidential mode, people are taking that as an example of what happens when, you know, companies can't be held accountable by these messages. What happens if they use confidential mode to hide evidence of these things? So things like that are kind of an issue. And Google says that its version is nuanced in that the emails are never truly destroyed, technically, making it more difficult to use it malevolently. But what it does is after the email expires, quote unquote, the confidential mode email continues to exist in the sender's sent folder and becomes a shell of an email with nothing but a subject line in the receiver's inbox. So you still get like the history of it kind of being in your inbox. And also to prevent negligent behavior from employees, the Google representative said that when the feature rolls out to companies, administrators will have the option to disable the feature internally and also reject incoming confidential mode emails. But fact of the matter is, you know, there's still a question on whether or not platforms using temporary messaging should be regulated further, because
I'm just looking at it as well. It says receive messages in confidential mode, do not explode, self-destruct, vanish or disappear. Why introduce this feature at all in email? I
can see it from a point of view. Let's say you're a journalist and you want to send confidential information to one of your people on the ground about, you know, I don't know whether it's troop movements or it's movements of a politician or something. You'd like that other person to get that data and that information, but you don't want to be seen as that person who's sending that information at some point.
But it never completely disappears anyway.
So what's left, I understand, in the sent box will just be a subject headline and the fact that there was something sent.
That's for the inbox. For the person who has sent the email does not disappear from your sent folder.
And there's something called screenshot.
Right.
There's also a screenshot. That's true.
Snapchat. Why are you making email disappear?
So, yeah. First of all, I'm not really sure exactly why this would come into play. I don't really understand why exactly people would need to send emails that disappear, except for malevolent means, really? Because, you know, James Bond does not exist. So I don't really see what else this can be used for apart from people who want to get rid of something.
I'm curious. Folks at home, just before we wrap up, you know, disappearing email, you know, is this something that you would use? And if you, okay, to give Chris some examples, you know, why potentially you might use it.
Yeah.
I mean, that would be interesting. Let us know, 018-789-8899 on WhatsApp, or get us on Twitter at BFM Radio. We have to take a short break. When we come back, we'll give you some events that we think you might want to check out over the next coming days. And then, of course, we'll give you some information about the Breakfast Grill replay. Don't go anywhere. You listen to Enterprise Biz Bytes here on BFM 89.9.
Bureaucratic failures multiply. BFM 89.9.
Welcome back to Enterprise Biz Bytes. It's pretty much time for us to wrap up for today. But of course, as usual, with it being Monday, we've got some events that we think you might want to check out.
All right. This one's happening tomorrow, and this is organized by the BFM community. This is our workshop session number 3, and it's data on a budget. This is 9 to 5 at the Grand Sofo in Klana Jaya. And the story behind this is that the advent of data analytics in business has allowed us to make better decisions faster. However, due to the costs involved, only enterprise-sized corporations with large budgets can afford extensive data analysis, so we think. So what can SMEs do to leverage on the power of data cheaply? To share their insights on this is Jan Wong and Daryl Tan, who are regular guests here in BFM. They're from Open Minds Resources, so they're going to be having this one-day workshop, and they'll be taking you on how to collect, analyze, and utilize data without breaking the bank. And this is designed specifically for retailers in mind. So what you need to do, though, is the workshop is about $200-$250. Join our community, bfm.my/community, and then get more information here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then we've got an event called Deeper and Instant Data Insights with Tableau and Alteryx. This is happening on Wednesday, June 13th from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. This is also happening at Southgate Commercial Center off Jalan Chan Sao Lin. It is a free event. So what it is about is that powerful data visualizations require rich, perfected data sets. Business users need a self-service data analytics platform that can deploy and share analytics at scale for deeper insights in hours, not weeks. Conjointly, analysts can easily prep, blend, and analyze all their data using a repeatable workflow without any scripting or programming with Alteryx and Tableau, and can easily consume analytics in a visually rich environment. So if you want to know more about these platforms, please attend this event and find out more about Alteryx and Tableau software.
Definitely. Both of those events, you can find more details at eventbrite.com. Check that out. It's time for us to move on then, folks. It's all the time we have for today. We'll quickly run through what we covered today, though. And if you miss any part of this show, don't forget you can always download the BFM app, which is available in the Apple App Store or on Google Play. We started off with a story about how Netflix and Facebook have been helping to reduce youth crime by keeping them off the streets and at home. Binge watching.
Yes. And then we talked about how Airbnb will let hosts sign up to donate emergency housing before a disaster as part of their open homes program.
Okay. And then we shared with you some skills on how your brain can be less racist. Because we all are.
Yeah. And then we talked about how Google says that its new disappearing email option, which is called confidential mode, will not be a liability for companies. But
Right. Don't go anywhere then, because coming up after the 1 o'clock news, of course, it is the Breakfast Grill replay. Now, it's with Golden Screen Cinemas. As the largest cinema chain in the country, Golden Screen Cinemas, GSC, are synonymous with the Malaysian movie-going experience. But with the advent of streaming services like Netflix and iFlix poaching audiences, can the cinema industry continue to grow? The Breakfast Grill spoke to the CEO, Ko Mei Lee, on the prospects of the industry in Malaysia and GSC's growth plans. My name is Rich Bradbury. On behalf of Frida Liu and Christine Wong, this has been Enterprise Biz Bytes. We'll take you out with some music from The Clash. It is Groovy Times here on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.